And joining us now in the studio, Soraya Chamali, an award-winning writer and activist whose work focuses on the role of gender in culture, politics, religion, and media. She is the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project and an advocate for women's freedom of expression and expanded civic and political engagement. And her latest book just out is Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Welcome to Background Briefing, Soraya Chamali.
Thank you so much, Ian.
So do you see this as a watershed moment now, with the Me Too movement sweeping the country and now this standoff between a growing number of accusers and a determined Senate of largely old white men who seem to be accelerating their determination to get Brett Kavanaugh confirmed to the Supreme Court?
I think that if you'd asked me this question Friday, it would be clear to all of us. I'm not convinced it's a watershed moment, honestly. I think we have to wait and see. I think that more than a sort of reenactment of what happened during the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings, I see this as a continuum. It's really one very long process. Some of the Republican members of the Judiciary Committee were actually members during those hearings, you know, and so I think there is a quality of anger, but I think, too, there is the disbelief and despair that we are doing this again and in this way. And actually, the charges leveled here are far more serious, in fact, and criminal. We're not just talking about sexual harassment, but brutal rape.
Gang rape. So in your book, though, Rage Becomes the Power of Women's Anger, you're almost suggesting that women should be weaponizing rage. But what we're learning, of course, and haven't known this before, is that these women have not spoken up. And, of course, they're being accused by the Senate Republicans, in effect, for not speaking up sooner, and the president himself. But the pattern has been, up until now, to sort of hold this in. And that has led to depression and pain and internalizing the pain for decades. So this is extraordinary. It's almost like women are being doubly punished.
Well, I mean, I think that it's very clear that some people understand the dynamics and neurobiology of trauma, and others don't, and they have no interest in it. And so we understand a lot about what happens when someone has been assaulted. And that's true whether the person is a young boy or a young girl, because boys and girls have equal chances of being assaulted more or less before the age of 10.
We've learned that from the abuse by Catholic priests.
That's right. And so, you know, it's not just that women experience these assaults and are traumatized by them. So do boys and men. But for women, coming forward has always meant incurring huge risks and penalty. We live in a systems-justifying culture. And so the response to someone who says something that is frightening to the culture, right? Because in essence, when you say these things, you're a whistleblower. And you're saying, not only did this happen to me, but I'm challenging the culture that has enabled it, and I'm describing it, and I'm actually holding people accountable. No one really wants that information. And so people will hold on to these stories because of the shame and the risk, and also because it's very clear we have example after example after example of the penalties that people face when they do say what happened to them, of the disbelief and the doubt. And, you know, I was sort of, today I'd noticed a headline that said there are now four people who are collaborating Christine Blasey Ford's story. And I thought, this is remarkable. I don't think that in general people understand how recently it was that our police departments stopped requiring collaboration when a victim of sexual assault made a report. It was the only crime in which a victim had to provide collaboration. You know, as late as sort of the early aughts, the Philadelphia Police Department sex crime unit was jokingly called the lying bitch unit. So I think that it's so pervasive in the culture that saying, oh, why didn't she come forward before is just a statement that you have no interest. You have no interest in understanding what's happening, and in fact, you probably are served politically by not understanding what's happening.
So what do you think is going to happen tomorrow? Because what you're talking about seems to be on the cards. The deck is stacked against this Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, and she's taking a huge risk, and
yes,
she's being very brave. And they've obviously covered there the fact that there are 11 old white men on the Republican side. They brought in an experienced sex crime prosecutor.
Right.
But still, even for a seasoned politician, being in that hot seat is tough.
It is tough. I think, you know, one of perhaps the only positive aspects of this is that she is herself an expert. She understands these dynamics. She had asked not to be questioned by a prosecutor. And I don't know if this is precisely why, but there is lots of research, well understood dynamics of courtroom prosecutorial procedures, adversarial procedures that are understood to undermine the testimony of a woman like Ford because of the linguistics, because of the adversarial nature of the question and answers. And so there are alternatives to that that Congress is not interested in. They're going to go down the old school line of proceeding in ways that have been demonstrably proven to basically institutionalize perpetrator perspectives. And so already from the get-go, she's in a situation in which she will be an individual essentially acting in isolation in the context of this bigger problem. And so having a woman prosecutor, of course, is a pretty cynical move, I think. Everybody does it in terms of patriarchal institutions. I mean, every time the Catholic Church has to make a statement, they trot out a woman spokeswoman to say it for them and sort of do the dirty work. And I think that's what we will see on Thursday.
So what do you expect then? I mean, there's another surreal nature, far from the fact that this deck is stacked against this woman who is the first accuser. The second accuser is not allowed to come or to be interviewed or even to be investigated by the FBI. And, of course, the same applies to the third accuser. And the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Grassley, has instructed the Democrats not to ask questions about the second or, in particular,
yes,
the third accuser. So,
and that's typical in courtroom proceedings, right, where you isolate all of the cases and you bar any contextualizing of the problem.
Right.
And it was remarkable, too, because earlier this year when we saw the Larry Nassar proceedings, what was so notable was that over 200 women were allowed to speak. They were all allowed to give testimony. And just the sheer force of the numbers, which tells you a lot about how many women it takes, right? Even in the case of Cosby, we know that there were 3, 4, 5 dozen women.
60
women in final count. And so,
but only one was
one in the case, right? That's exactly right. And so here, that's what they're doing. They're trying to isolate this one woman, isolate what she's saying, and close off that kind of contextualizing, close off the effect of having three incredibly competent women who have asked for an FBI investigation and who, for better or worse, are providing corroborative evidence.
Well, what particularly irritates me about this situation is that it feels like the tyranny of the minority that we've had, because we have a minority,
yes,
president, and in effect, even though the Republicans control the House and Senate, they get fewer votes than Democrats because they rigged the system through gerrymandering and the Electoral, mm-hmm, College, or as some refer to it, the slave state college. So that's irritating enough. But now it seems manifestly clear that what's going on here is the tyranny of the minority being amped up. And the fact that Kavanaugh went on Fox News, which addresses the one-third base that Trump has, the, mm-hmm, 30%. That's their echo chamber, and they keep people inside a bubble of delusion where they're impermeable to facts and evidence. The fact that he did that indicates to me that this is a minority judge. This is a man who is only going to respect and respond to one-third of this country at most.
Yeah,
so in other words, my anger is about at what point does the two-thirds step up? And what can we, I guess the all we can do is vote in November, right?
Right.
And that seems kind of pathetic compared to the in-your-face aggression that this one-third of this country is exercising at the moment.
Well, I think it's interesting because there is this sense, prevalence of this idea of American exceptionalism, that somehow we had this shining democracy when, in fact, the truth is that for most of our history, only a very small percentage, ultimately, of the population had full citizenship rights, had full rights to political power and efficacy. And we're seeing the curtains pulled back from that today in new and different ways. And so the very concentrated power and disproportionate power that white Christian evangelical, often men, have had in state legislatures and now in Congress is there for everyone to see and to decide. Do you want to get out the vote? Do you want to go out and vote? Do you want to run for office? Because it's going to take this monumental shift in who feels that they can be meaningful political actors. So many people feel disenfranchised, and at the same time, so many other people feel so entitled. And somehow we have to equalize that playing field so that people actually feel that their political system not only does represent them, because it doesn't, but can actually represent them.
Well, you've heard my rage and frustration about how come the two-thirds of this country are being rolled by the one-third, and what the hell are we going to do about it? Because it's absolutely insupportable and insufferable. So tell me about your rage and women's rage.
Well, where to begin, right? So, you know, a lot of people, I've just published this book. It's been 2 weeks. I've been on a book tour. And there are people who, you know, feel very strongly, which they share, that we shouldn't be advocating for an increase in rage. And that's really a miscategorization of what I'm talking about and what other feminist writers who are writing about this topic right now are saying. Essentially what we're saying is this rage is here. It has always been here. There are times in the culture that allow women to display and express anger more acceptably, and those times tend to be times of political crisis. But then what happens is there's almost inevitable backlash and a reassertion of gender norms and a kind of sex segregation into public and private space. And I think what's notably, there are several things that are notably different this time, which I hope are a silver lining to the current sort of disastrous regime that we're all living with. And that is that women do have more economic power than they've had before. There are more women running for office, and there are more women winning. We also have a generation of women who've grown up with Title IX. And although many people associate that with sports, it's really, really about leadership. And so not only have women grown up as girls used to playing on teams, learning about the difference between aggressiveness and anger, learning to work across conflict. You know, those are not skills that we tend to teach girls in traditional gender socializing ways. Not only do they have Title IX themselves, but they have a generation even of role models who also had Title IX. And so the kind of political expression, the efflorescence that we're seeing right now, I'm hoping marks that kind of social shift where the anger that we have is not going to be pushed back into private, but will be sustained in terms of changing our ideas of leadership and our ideas of citizenship.
And does this tie into the debate going on within the Democratic Party between the progressive wing and the corporate wing, where the corporate wing is saying to the progressive wing, we love your energy, we want you to get out the vote, particularly with millennials and the minorities, but don't talk about impeachment?
I think it does. I mean, I think what's interesting to me, certainly living in Washington, is the number of people who seem to feel very strongly that the way to win the next presidential election is to somehow magically convert Trump voters by putting forward a, you know, a sort of nice, smart, probably white guy, you know. And I just don't think that's going to work in this environment. I really think that we have to get out the vote. We need to address the issues that progressives have put front and forward. I mean, there are huge shifts. We've seen the shifts, like even healthcare. You look at the conversation about healthcare, and I think we're somewhere now that a lot of people could never have even imagined 5 years ago. And that's because of this progressive push. So I do think it ties into it. I think that a lot of the impressions we have of anger and political anger are tied very much to the idea of an angry white man. So during the 90s and since, there have been a lot of books written about that, about the Tea Party and about the negativity of that kind of emotion and anger. But in fact, the same way that that anger has been linked to shame and contempt and disgust, which you saw all over Trump's rallies, it similarly connected to empathy and compassion and the search for social justice. There's nothing intrinsically negative about the emotion. And so if we can capture that, those feelings, and we can channel them politically as women, then I think that we stand a fighting chance.
Well, there's no greater exemplar of the angry white man than President Trump.
No, I think that's right. He's really a materialization of that.
And he, incidentally, keeps talking about Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas.
Yes, he does.
And understanding he's a weak, strong man. He's a frail egotist. It's just paradoxical. But I do believe that he singles her out because he recognizes her as the main political rival in 2020.
That's interesting.
And to my mind, I think if you look at the Senate debate where the other great misogynist, Mitch McConnell, tried to silence her through arcane procedural methods, and the look on her face, but the determination, but she didn't get strident, which is the buzzword that's used about women. But she showed enormous strength and patience and almost looked down on this terrible man.
Yes, and I think that this actually marks another huge shift, which is social media. So the project that I work on with the Women's Media Center is really about the negative aspects of social media that are weaponized against women. So the harassment, the threats, the impersonation, the doxing, all of the tools that are used at great scope and amplification to shut down women's participation or threaten them, which we just saw happen with Christine Ford. You know, she's had to go into hiding. This is exactly what she was trying to avoid. It's very invasive. It's very dangerous. But having said all of that, in fact, when Mitch McConnell silenced Elizabeth Warren, he actually flipped the switch on a huge movement, right? I mean, nevertheless, she persisted within minutes or hours, had taken on a life of its own because it really resonated with women. Women are like, yes, of course. We all understand what just happened. It happened to her. It happens to us every day. It happens to us at home. It happens to us at work. It happens to us if we're at rallies. And so you can't count anymore on shutting down a woman like that and having it just be a sort of small closed room issue, because it's not a small closed room issue. And now there's this immense tool that enables us to communicate with each other. You could isolate a girl or woman in the house very easily 40 years ago, 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. And it's still happening in some places in the U.S. and certainly in the world today. But just the ability to reach out to that network and to talk to other girls and women is revolutionary. We really don't understand the impact of that, and we won't for a long time.
Well, just in the last minute, given this watershed moment, how do you see women's rage translating either in victory, if indeed Kavanaugh has to withdraw or he doesn't get the votes in the Senate, or that they push him through? Because, again, in the back of my mind is always the day after the inauguration of Donald Trump, millions of women showed up here in the United States and around the world. And that showed me that there's a movement, not necessarily a sustaining movement, but my feeling is that this is going to accelerate the revitalization of that movement.
I mean, I certainly think so. I probably, like you, am not convinced that they will not confirm this man. I think that for a lot of the members of the right, this is an inconvenience and it's, you know, political game and they're going to just do it anyway. And so if that happens, I think we will see again this massive wave, this outpouring of anger. And I'm hoping that we can capture that anger in the election, in the midterm elections, and that it is sustained. I mean, in the same way that we saw the legacy of the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings, I mean, there are women in Congress today because of that, because they understood how important it was to be in the room. And I think that actually, regardless of whether he's confirmed or not, that will happen again, because we need to have parity in political representation. We need to have parity in media representation. And sadly, whether we're disappointed or not, it sometimes takes this kind of genuinely obscene display of carelessness for women to make people act.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in the studio, Soraya Chamali. And again, Soraya Chamali is an award-winning writer and activist whose work focuses on the role of gender in cultures, politics, religion, and media. And she's the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project and an advocate for women's freedom of expression and expanded civic and political engagement. And her latest book just out is Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the legal ramifications of the sworn statement by the third accuser of Brett Kavanaugh.